The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. Today I'm going to talk about the prospect of war with Iran. There's been a great deal of talk for months about the dangers of that Iran supposedly poses to the United States, to Israel, and to the region if it develops nuclear weapons. This talk has been going on actually for years, but seems to have reached a new high point in recent months, particularly during the Republican primary election campaign, in which all of the leading Republican candidates, with the notable exception, of course, of Ron Paul, have been hammering away at the great danger posed by Iran should it develop nuclear weapons. And this has been fired up by the rhetoric of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, notably just recently when he visited Washington to speak at a large convention of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the leading Zionist lobby group in Washington. President Obama also addressed the convention and pledged his absolute support for Israel and its security, along with other Republican candidates, all have been over and over emphasizing their pledges of support for Israel and its security, not only as a so-called democratic state, but also explicitly as a Jewish ethno-religious state. But the question of war or peace in Iran, and the prospect of war with Iran, is an artificial crisis. This is a crisis every bit as phony as the one manufactured to provide a pretext for war against Iraq in the months before the U.S. strike against Iraq and invasion and bombing of that country in March of 2003. Once again, leaders in the United States and Israel preparing the American public for a new war. We're told once again that another country that Israel regards as an adversary is a grave threat to the peace of the world. The falsehoods and the rhetoric that we're hearing is so similar to the bellicose rhetoric and the alarmist rhetoric in 2002 and early 2003, and often from the very same people, it's amazing that anyone takes all of this very seriously. President Obama and other high-ranking U.S. officials are carrying on a policy similar to that of his predecessor, George W. Bush, in pressuring and threatening Iran, including repeated threats of military attack if the government in Tehran does not give up its nuclear development program. You might remember that in the administration of George W. Bush, his Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, declared the pursuit by the Iranian regime of nuclear weapons represents a direct threat to the entire international community, including to the United States and to the Persian Gulf region. President Obama and, of course, leading Republican politicians have been saying similar things in more recent years about the supposed grave threat posed by Iran. President Obama and other high-ranking Obama administration officials have ominously declared that all options are on the table. That's a polite way of saying that the United States is considering every form of even military action, including nuclear attack, even the use of nuclear weapons against Iran if Iran does not back down from its alleged nuclear weapons program. The U.S. disrespect for international law has become so familiar in recent years that very few Americans, it seems, care that that kind of rhetoric is itself not only outrageous and alarmist and dangerous, but is itself a violation of international law. Of course, we're used to Israeli leaders such as Benjamin Netanyahu portraying the so-called danger of war in the most alarmist terms, but in this broadcast, I'm going to try to look more soberly at the dangers of supposed Iranian threat, to separate some of the alarmist rhetoric from the reality here, and also look at the background behind this newest and latest campaign for another war by Israel or by the United States or by both against a country that Israel regards as an adversary. Now, there's a lot of very useful, very insightful, very good articles, analysis of the Iranian situation posted on the IHR website. I don't want to go over all of this and repeat everything there, but I, for those people who do care about the facts and the reality of the whole situation, I turn your attention, I direct your attention to some of the articles that have already appeared on our website. But a few things need to be stressed, that some of the most common and often repeated claims about this so-called threat from Iran are simply untrue. The American Republican political leaders have been giving the impression that Iran either does or already is very close to developing a nuclear weapon. In fact, that's not true. Even the International Atomic Energy Agency and American intelligence officials concede or acknowledge that the common assumption that Iran already has a nuclear bomb is wrong. Even Israeli intelligence agrees about this. And even though a majority of the American public, according to public opinion polls, believe that Israel either has or is building a nuclear weapon, a view that's reinforced by Republican candidates for the presidency, this is simply not the case. In fact, it's not even clear that Iran has even made a decision to build a nuclear weapon. Iran's nuclear weapons program, so far, is a peaceful one. And this has been confirmed by any number of officials and even the International Atomic Energy Agency. Even American intelligence officials concede that there's no evidence that even a decision has been made to develop a nuclear weapon. In fact, many have pointed out that the main decision maker in Iran, Ali Khamenei, has consistently forbidden, on the basis of Islam, the acquisition, merely the acquisition of nuclear weapons. Now, he may be dishonest, but certainly the rhetoric coming out of Iran by its most prominent leaders gives no reason to believe that they're lying about this. But if they are lying, it should be incumbent, of course, upon those who make that claim to provide some real evidence of it. The claims made over and over that Iran is speeding head-on toward nuclear capability have been made for years, and the deadlines and the claims made over and over by especially Israeli leaders about how close Iran is to a nuclear weapon the nuclear bomb have come and gone over the years. Another common claim that's made is that Iran's leaders are so irrational that they can't be trusted. But this is simply not the case. Even the former head of the Israeli Mossad, their equivalent or counterpart of the CIA, a man named Meir Dagan, has even declared that the regime in Iran, he says, is a very rational one. It is not carrying out the actions. Its policies are not that of an irrational, crazy regime. The America's top-ranking military officer, General Martin Dempsey, told CNN that the United States is of the opinion that the Iranian regime is a rational one. And above all, Iran's leadership wants to preserve their power and their place. They don't want to go in some crazy adventure of a military campaign that would mean the destruction of their entire regime. Several high-ranking U.S. military, intelligence, and State Department officials took out an ad recently in the Washington Post urging President Obama to stand fast against political and lobbying pressure, above all, from AIPAC and the Israel lobby to attack Iran because it supposedly is trying to develop nuclear weapons. This letter was signed by 5 retired generals, 2 senior intelligence analysts, and a senior State Department official, who also cited statements by other military defense officials warning against the dangers of war and against an attack against Iran. Adding to the voices of caution have been, as I mentioned already, the former head of Israel's Mossad spy agency, Meir Dagan, who warns that an attack against Iran would be stupid. One of the most insightful and detailed and measured analyses of this entire issue was written recently by a professor at Georgetown University, a specialist in international affairs named Paul Pillar. It appeared in the Washington Monthly and has generated a great deal of discussion. And he looks very carefully at all aspects, all the important aspects of this issue. In this article, entitled "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran," he makes the point that when one strips away the bellicosity and political rhetoric, what one finds is not rigorous analysis in the American media and by American politicians, but a mixture of fear, fanciful speculation, and crude stereotyping. Now, he and others make the point that there are good reasons to oppose Iranian acquisition of nuclear weapons. And there are many things the United States and the international community can and should do to try to do that, to try to make sure that Iran does not develop a nuclear weapon. But, Professor Pillar goes on, Iran with a bomb would not be anywhere near as dangerous as most people assume, and a war to try to stop Iran from acquiring one would be less successful and far more costly than most people imagine. He points out that very few of those who talk about the danger of a nuclear-armed Iran can explain exactly why Iran with a nuclear weapon would be so dangerous. Now, the most common explanation given for this, and you'll hear this echoed by Republican candidates for the presidency, is that the Iranian leaders are supposedly insane. They're supposedly driven by such a crazed religious fervor that they're willing to plunge their nation into war and die themselves so that they can all go to heaven. Well, in fact, Rick Santorum has gone so far as to claim that Iran is ruled by what he calls the equivalent of Al-Qaeda, the terrorist organization, and that the theology of Iran's leaders teaches that its objective is, as he put it, to create a calamity. that the principal virtue of this outlook, according to Santorum and others like him, is martyrdom. Newt Gingrich has spoken in similar terms about how Iran's leaders are suicidal holy warriors, and says that it's impossible to deter them. Well, as Professor Pillar and many others have pointed out, this image of Iran does not reflect actual Iranian behavior. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been in power since the Shah was overthrown in 1978. And during the more than three decades that the Islamic Republic has been in place, demonstrates that the rulers of this country are overwhelmingly concerned with preserving their regime and their power in this life, not in some future one. They're no more likely to let theological imperatives lead them into self-destructive behavior than other leaders whose religious faiths envision an afterlife. Iranian rulers may have a history of valorizing martyrdom when they sent many young militiamen to their deaths during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, but they have never given any indication of wanting to become martyrs themselves. In fact, the Islamic Republic of Iran's conduct beyond its own borders has been characterized by caution, and even the most seemingly ruthless Iranian behavior has been motivated by specific immediate concerns of regime survival. If the stereotyped image of Iranian leaders had any real basis in fact, we would see more aggressive and brash Iranian behavior in the Middle East than we have. Now, some have pointed to the furious way that Iranians fought during the Iraq-Iranian War of the 1980s. But this was not an aggressive war carried out by Iran, but a response to an attack against Iran by Iraq. During that terrible war, which cost hundreds of thousands of lives, the United States, in fact, supported Saddam Hussein. And Iran was fighting on its own territory, fighting for its own survival, and as one would expect any country to do so if it was similarly attacked. Now, Pillar also points out and compares the U.S. response to other countries having nuclear weapons over the years. It's important to put this in some sort of larger context. Iran is not the only revolutionary regime that has had or has come close or might have nuclear weapons. The Soviet Union had, of course, an enormous nuclear arsenal, larger than any country's except the United States. And China, to this day, has a nuclear weapons arsenal. Its only ruling party is the Communist Party. Both India and Pakistan have nuclear weapons, as does France and Britain. But even though the Soviet Union had an enormous military arsenal, the United States never seriously contemplated going to war against the Soviet Union. And eventually, of course, the Soviet Union broke up. Russia even today still has a nuclear arsenal. But no reasonable or rational person believes that because a country has nuclear weapons, it should therefore be attacked, even if the government is a revolutionary one. Eventually, of course, the United States dealt with communist China not by attacking it, but by conciliating with it, and represented by the visit, much heralded visit by President Nixon to China, in which he met with Mao Zedong, who was far more ruthless than even toward his own people than Iran's leaders are said to be by Republican candidates and Republican leaders and even some Democrats. Senator John McCain has said there's only one thing worse than military action against Iran, and that is a nuclear-armed Iran. But as Professor Pillar and others have pointed out, any careful look at the balance sheet on this issue yields the opposite conclusion. Military action against Iran would have consequences far worse than a nuclear-armed Iran. War or a world with an Iranian bomb are not the only alternatives. Michelle Bachmann is no longer a candidate, but she heated up the rhetoric over Iran. And she claimed, when she was running for president, that the Iranian president Ahmadinejad has said that if he has a nuclear weapon, he will use it to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Well, that's simply untrue. It's not true. It's an alarming thing, a sobering thing, to realize that Michelle Bachmann and other American leaders who make false statements like this are not really held to account. And Michelle Bachmann's perversion of the truth doesn't seem to have hurt her in any serious way. So why is it that Netanyahu's government keeps on talking about the danger of Iran and the need to attack it or to keep it from having nuclear weapons? Well, one important motive, according to Professor Pillar, is that this is a way of shifting attention in the United States and around the world from the Israel-Palestine issue. The Netanyahu government's continuing expansion of settlements on the West Bank are themselves illegal under international law and are a violation of Security Council Resolution 242, which has the force of international law, which the United States presidents have repeatedly affirmed. But by diverting attention from Israel's own actions and by claiming that Iran is the great danger, Netanyahu and Israeli leaders shift attention to this supposed threat from Iran. Even if Iran acquired a bomb, Israel would still retain overwhelming military superiority. Most international specialists of these issues claim and believe that Israel has a nuclear arsenal of 100, perhaps even as many as 200 nuclear weapons, as well as a very modern and sophisticated delivery system, a delivery system that includes nuclear-powered submarines supplied by Germany. As Professor Pillar concludes, that is part of the reason why an Iranian nuclear weapon would not be an existential threat to Israel and would not give Iran a license to become more of a regional troublemaker. But a war with Iran, begun by either Israel or the United States, would push Israel farther into the hole of perpetual conflict and regional isolation. It's important to realize the extent to which once wars begin, they have a way of spinning out of control. Over and over again in history, countries miscalculate about the way in which wars develop. In 1914, none of the leaders of any of the major countries that went to war in 1914 anticipated or foresaw at all the enormous bloodletting, the enormous catastrophe that was the First World War, when President Johnson greatly increased the number of American troops in Vietnam and escalated the Vietnam War. He failed and did not foresee just how catastrophic ultimately that turned out to be. And of course, notably, the United States is now 11 years into war in Afghanistan, which has turned out very, very differently than anyone expected, except for those people who understand something about history, expected when the United States invaded and occupied Afghanistan in 2001 in the aftermath of 9/11. Here it is 11 years later, a period longer than U.S. involvement in both the First and Second World Wars combined, and there seems to be no end to this horrible mess. In the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which is something like the New York Times of Israel, the Israeli analyst Sefi Rachlevsky stress that what Netanyahu is trying to do by heating up the rhetoric is trying to create a situation that will mean the United States supports Israel if it attacks Iran and drag the United States into a war that would have devastating consequences for everyone. Well, we're taking a break at this point, and I'll resume in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Our top story now. Syria's turmoil has been laid bare on our TV screens for more than a year. But some networks are being accused of affecting rather than reflecting the conflict. Mira Fanoshina reports now on how there's more to the coverage on the Qatari-owned Al Jazeera TV channel than meets the eye.
Clashes in the streets of Syria have been raging for a year now. But behind the scenes, there is a media war that's just as damaging as the one taking Syrian lives. Rafiq Lotf, freelance investigative journalist from Damascus, says he's found what he thinks is proof of media manipulation of the conflict in Syria. In this video from the Syrian town of Homs, the camera focuses on the city's oil refinery. The shooting begins 7 hours before media viewers around the world see a pipeline explosion allegedly caused by Assad's army bombardment. You can clearly see that something is slowly burning in the distance. When the smoke has thickened, English speakers correct the camera's position for a better shot of what's going on. They shake it to make it look like amateur video.
I know this video is on the Al Jazeera server. It's clear it's not an explosion, but they ignore that and keep on reporting it the way they need to see it.
In another video from a hospital in Homs, someone behind camera talks to a doctor. In the corner, we see little Nakhem.
When you are on air, you should tell Bashar God will punish you and then talk about his wife, okay? Let's rehearsal again.
After some 30 minutes of waiting, the crew starts to get nervous.
Let's call Al Arabiya, maybe. For how long can we wait?
No, we need Al Jazeera.
While live on Al Jazeera eventually, the girl will forget some details.
God punish you, Bashar, and your children.
In this footage, we see Danny, a Homs activist known for his exclusive reports from the very epicenter of the conflict. He's preparing to go live on CNN, and there is no shooting until he asks for it.
What shall I say?
Tell them there are some buildings collapsed, and we're taking bodies away.
You say there could be as many as 200 dead just in the last hour or two?
We have 200 dead in the last 3 hours. In the first half an hour, we've got 40 dead. In the first half an hour, and we got the video up on YouTube.
The activists who become journalists try to make their shows as hard as possible. The more blood and death, the higher the price.
But not everyone is happy about it. Well-known war correspondent Ali Hashem used to report for Al Jazeera from the world's conflict hotspots, but Syria has become the Rubicon he couldn't cross. He mentioned armed groups fighting against Assad's army, and his bosses in Doha told him he needed a vacation. Ali has just resigned because of biased coverage, he says.
Somewhere like, promote.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. I'm talking in this broadcast about the prospect of war with Iran. The rhetoric has been heating up enormously in recent months, especially during the Republican primary election campaign, and in recent weeks when leading political figures, including President Obama, addressed a convention of the most powerful Israel lobbying group in Washington, the APAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee. One man who knows a great deal about U.S. policy in the Middle East and has written and commented on it is Scott Ritter, an American who served as a senior United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. He wrote a book entitled Target Iran, and he wrote it during the Bush administration, but what he has to say in this book applies equally well to the Obama administration. He wrote, "The Bush administration, with the able help of the Israeli government and the pro-Israel lobby, has succeeded in exploiting the ignorance of the American people about nuclear technology and nuclear weapons, so as to engender enough fear that the American public has more or less been pre-programmed to accept the notion of the need to militarily confront a nuclear-armed Iran." Scott Ritter also writes, "Let there be no doubt, if there is an American war with Iran, it is a war that was made in Israel and nowhere else." It's important to remember that an attack against Iran by the United States or Israel would be in the absence of an imminent threat, an illegal unilateral act of war. It would be a so-called preventive war against a country that doesn't even have a nuclear weapon. It's only against a country based on supposedly what it might do. But a war against Iran would serve only Israeli and Zionist interests. For everyone else, war against Iran would be a catastrophe. Now, this is important to understand because it's remarkable to look at just who's talking about war against Iran and who's opposed to it. The Netanyahu government, the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, has been warning about the danger of Iran even developing a capability for a nuclear weapon. But he has been countered by voices even within Israel about the grave dangers of that an attack against Iran would entail. And of course, Netanyahu's alarmist talk has been backed up by American politicians who are beholden to the Jewish lobby here in the United States. But around the world, and even here in the United States, virtually everyone who is familiar with the overall Middle East situation and who is not in the beholden to the Israel lobby has been warning about the dangers of such a war. Zbigniew Brzezinski, a former national security advisor in the Clinton administration, has been outspoken in warning about the grave dangers that an attack against Iran would involve for the United States and the world. A high-ranking Russian official has said that an attack against Iran by Israel or the United States would be regarded in Russia as a threat to Russia's own security interests. And of course, leaders in Europe, in China, and around the world have been warning and cautioning against this dangerous rhetoric and the dangers of a war. But for many years now, American political leaders of both parties have been staunchly committed to Israel and its security. This singular devotion to Israel is an expression of the Jewish Zionist grip on America's political and cultural life. A good example of that, in fact, an outstanding example of this unbelievable blank check commitment to Israel was made recently and acknowledged by the U.S. ambassador to Israel, appointed by President Obama. The U.S. ambassador, Daniel Shapiro, in September acknowledged a point that we've been making for years, that U.S. policy in the Middle East is driven by concern for Israel's security and identity as a Jewish ethno-religious state. By implication, Shapiro acknowledged that U.S. policy in the Middle East is not driven by what's best for America and the world. Now here's what Shapiro said. The test of every policy the administration develops in the Middle East is whether it is consistent with the goal of ensuring Israel's future as a secure Jewish democratic state. That is a commitment that runs as a common thread through our entire government. Now, this is remarkable, amazing. The test of every policy the administration develops in the Middle East, said Shapiro, is whether it's consistent with Israel's future as a Jewish state. And again, to emphasize, I'm repeating that this is a commitment that runs as a common thread to the entire U.S. government. Now, the U.S. makes no similar pledge to any other country. Try to imagine President Obama or President Bush, for example, saying that the U.S. is strongly committed to the security of Pakistan as a Muslim state, or the security of Australia as a white European state, or the security of Portugal as a Catholic state. The U.S. doesn't make a commitment like that to any other country. This commitment to Israel was reflected also in a statement by Condoleezza Rice, who was National Security Advisor and later U.S. Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration. She said in an interview in 2003 that the security of Israel is the key to the security of the world. Now imagine, if you can, it's difficult to imagine an American leader making a similar statement about any other country. Imagine a U.S. Secretary of State saying, for example, that the security of Nigeria or Russia or Serbia is the key to the security of the world. It's unthinkable. In fact, it would be laughable. Contrary to the impression given by Republican candidates for the presidency and by much of the alarmist media, the pro-Israel media in the United States, Iran was never allied with or even friendly to the Al-Qaeda organization or the Taliban regime in neighboring Afghanistan. The American media likes to give the impression that Iran, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, they're all crazed Muslims. In fact, this is ridiculous. In 1999, Iran almost went to war against Taliban-ruled Afghanistan after Taliban fighters kidnapped and murdered 9 Iranian diplomats. But the American media obscures and confuses the issue by trying to portray all Muslims or Muslim fighters or the Taliban and so forth as all the same thing and all similar to Iran. Now, it's also often claimed by American, especially Republican leaders like Michelle Bachmann and so forth, that Iran is a grave danger to Jews. Of course, Jews do not have anything like the power and influence in Iran that they have here in the United States. But the insinuation that Iran's Jews are somehow terrorized or oppressed is rubbish, or that Iran is determined to kill Jews as a second Hitler. This kind of rhetoric by Benjamin Netanyahu and others in the Israel Jewish lobby is simply empty rhetoric, dangerous rhetoric. Jews have far more freedom in Iran than they do in several Middle Eastern countries that are allied with the United States, such as Saudi Arabia or Pakistan. Iran's Jewish community of some 25,000 is represented in the nation's parliament by a Jewish representative. There are 20 active synagogues in Tehran. The Jews of Iran, many of whom own and run successful businesses, have a standard of living that is above the country's average. To put the Iran crisis into some perspective, it's worth noting that Iran has not attacked another country in 200 years. It has itself repeatedly been a victim of aggression. And a look at the historical record shows that Iran has at least some valid reason to be skeptical of Washington's policies and intentions. In 1991, during World War II, military forces of Britain and the Soviet Union, with backing from the United States, invaded and occupied Iran in flagrant violation of international law. The British and Soviet Russian occupation forces removed the government in Tehran, which was considered too sympathetic to Germany, and installed the youthful Mohammad Reza Pahlavi as the country's Shah or monarch, who, of course, was overthrown in 1978. In 1953, the United States, operating through the Central Intelligence Agency and acting in concert with the British, organized the overthrow of the popular government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh and brought back to power the Shah, who had briefly fled the country. From 1953 until 1979, not 78 as I mentioned, the United States generously supported the Shah, a ruler who became increasingly out of touch with the interests and aspirations of his people. And he was overthrown, of course, by a popular uprising in 1979 and fled into exile. During the 1980s, Iran and Iraq were involved in a war over nearly 8 years, one of the most destructive in the 20th century. Casualty figures are uncertain, but certainly hundreds of thousands of people died in the war. But the U.S. role in that conflict was a cynical one. While the U.S. provided aid and support to Iraq, the government of Saddam Hussein, and to cement that support, Donald Rumsfeld, who later served as Secretary of Defense in the George W. Bush administration, flew to Baghdad in December of 1983 as a special envoy of President Reagan to meet and shake hands with Saddam Hussein and reaffirm U.S. backing in the war against Iran. It's also important to keep in context that the only country that currently has nuclear weapons arsenal in the Middle East that occupies territory of its neighbors and which is in violation of United Nations Security Council resolutions is Israel. If the United States held Israel to the same standards that it has demanded or applied to Iraq and is now insisting on in terms with Iran, American bombers and missiles would be blasting Tel Aviv, and American troops would seize Israel's leaders and put them behind bars for war crimes and crimes against humanity. But this rhetoric about war, these assurances and pledges of security given by American political leaders, both Democratic and Republican, assurances that the U.S. makes to no other country in that way, is a reflection, expression of the Jewish Zionist grip on our political and cultural life. Now, such a lobby or power, particularly one that represents the interests of a self-absorbed community that makes up no more than 3 or 4% of the population, could only gain such a hold on the governmental machinery of a society that is fundamentally sick and corrupt. No healthy society would permit a small minority to gain and hold such power and wield it for its own particular interests. This power not only wields this power for its own interests, but has so confused and misled the American public that the American people are simply perhaps the most misguided, misled public anywhere in the world. A recent public opinion poll showed that 7 in 10 Americans, 71%, according to a CNN Opinion Research Corporation survey, believe that Iran already has nuclear weapons. Only 1 in 4 disagreed with this. And more than 6 in 10, 60%, according to this poll, thinks the United States should take economic and diplomatic efforts to get Iran to shut down its nuclear program. Now, this is a reflection of the systematic misinformation peddled by the American media about Iran. But this confusion of the American public, this ignorance of the American public, systematically fomented and encouraged by the American media and by leading politicians is a reflection of a very seriously ill society. This isn't the first time that the American public has been so badly misled by a media that does not reflect authentic American interests or authentic humanitarian interests. In 2003, at the time of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, public opinion polls showed that 7 in 10 Americans believed that a majority of Americans believed that the United States had found clear evidence that Saddam Hussein was working closely with the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization that had carried out, so the Bush administration said, the 9/11 attack. 52% believed that the Iraqi government, and Al-Qaeda were working together. Now, in fact, there's absolutely no evidence of this. It's untrue, as American specialists, in fact, it makes no sense even that the Saddam Hussein government would have a close relationship or any kind of collaborative relationship. But the fact that in 2003, a majority of the American public could believe this falsehood, and that today a majority of the American public believes equally the falsehood that Iran has nuclear weapons, is a reflection of a very sick and corrupt society. Former U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said, or is supposed to have said, everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but not to his own facts. Well, the American public, apparently, believes things that are simply untrue, and in this ignorance, fortified and encouraged by irresponsible politicians who put their own political careers above the interests of the American people and of the world, this is the situation in America today. Thomas Jefferson once said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. There's something confusion and ignorance of the American public and the systematic way in which the American people are misled, misguided, and misinformed underscores the truth of what Jefferson said, that this is a society of people who are easily swayed. The founding fathers of America were very intelligent men, but in all their wisdom, they did not foresee, and perhaps could not have possibly foreseen, the enormous power wielded in our society by the mass media. The ability of images on television screens and in motion pictures to influence the thinkings of millions of people is something that no one in the 18th century could have foreseen. But it has a real power and impact in the real world because it influences political life and so forth. It influences real policy. But to allow the American media to be controlled by people who wield it not for the good of the public or not for the good of humanity or the world, but instead for their own narrow interests, is a very dangerous situation and, in fact, is a crucial factor in America's grave crisis today of its entire system. The prospect of war with Iran and the pledges by American political leaders, unique pledges to Israel and their subordination, their pandering to the power of the Israel lobby, the Jewish lobby in the United States, is just one manifestation of a society that has lost its moorings, that is fundamentally corrupt, fundamentally ill. And that's why replacing this or that politician, or replacing this party with that party, is not going to change that fundamental reality as long as this system is in place, because it allows decisive power to be wielded in the media by a small minority that's accountable to no one except itself and its own in own interests. And this means inevitably the election of of candidates who are interested in their own careers and their own partisan interests above and beyond the interests of the nation and of the world. Will there be war with Iran? That's very difficult to say. Some believe that all the hyper rhetoric about a possibility of war with Iran is a cynical, that there will not be a war. No one can tell. But heating up the rhetoric in this way has a impact of creating its own reality, making it very difficult to climb down. But one thing is clear, that U.S. support, blank check support for Israel and its security as Israel sees, defines it, means that the United States is beholden to the policies of a government that is harmful to American interests and the authentic interests of the world. That's what's really at the root of this. The biggest problem is this is not one of whether there's war, but a reflection of something fundamentally wrong with the American political system, reflected not just in our foreign policy, but also in our domestic policy. And in this regard, promoting public awareness about the background of this conflict is only part of encouraging greater public awareness of the, not only about history, but the how and why behind these trends and the this dynamic, so that we can, out of all of this, have a world that's more sane, more just, more peaceful, and more healthy than the one we have now. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. I encourage comments, questions, and suggestions, and criticisms, and of course compliments too from listeners for future broadcasts and of those we've already had. I hope you'll join me next time for the next Mark Weber Report.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.